Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for a book I should be thankful for. Does that make sense? Thankful?
Yeah, yeah. Thankful.
Yeah.
It's the season.
Tis the season.
Tis the season of thankfulness.
Tis the season. Happy thankful season. To help me are two thankful
turkeys. Two turkeys.
To help me are two turkeys. Also, high school English teachers, Ian and Joe.
My name is Joe Daffodil 11 Holeshoe and what? Nick. I am you'll see. Okay. Yeah, Nick. I'm a high school English teacher, and Nick, this week I brought a book that I'm incredibly thankful for. I brought Kurt Vonnegut's second time 1976 novel Slapstick. He called it the worst book he'd ever written.
so he was not thankful.
No, he gave it a D minus. I give it an A plus.
Hey, passing
the
grade.
Irony.
Passing grade.
D minus is not.
What's that thing they say? D's get degrees? No.
They don't say nope. That. I don't think D's a passing grade. You guys are it English is. Teachers, shouldn't you know this?
Oh no, Nick, there is a thing that we call a gentleman's D. And what a gentleman's D is.
Yes. Well, I can neither confirm nor deny, but yes, I have heard of this thing.
Yeah. So, Nick, what a gentleman's D is every once in a while you have a student in your class who really doesn't behave or like perform at the level that you would hope for a student.
Stabbing people, for instance.
Yeah. Like doesn't turn in a lot of work. Doesn't really hold up his end of the bargain. But what happens is all involved parties get together. And you make a gentleman's agreement that the student will pass with a D minus. So I can assure you that D's, Nick, do get degrees.
Wow. This is disturbing. All right.
Well, it's like, I mean, the F is a really harsh thing. The F says basically like you need to go over all of this stuff again. And there are situations where I say like, yes, my student did a pretty bad job with this, but like they demonstrated some level of competency.
Mm.
I don't know.
Like, yeah, no, I'm
anytime
on board.
You have a graduated grading scale, you're going to have issues like this.
I hope you guys are bringing that high bar to this podcast episode today.
Obviously. My name is Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher, gobble gobble. And Nick, if you're looking for a book to be thankful for, I think you should read our first listener recommendation. Silverlock by John Myers Myers, recommended by Rachel. Thank you, Rachel.
Is that a loyal lithead?
Loyal lithead.
Loyal lithead.
Rachel.
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 You're going to summon her. So I don't like this.
I think you could have said a book that you should gobble up. Like you could have transitioned it into. You want to? We could take it from the top.
Take it from the top.
Fine. Right. I need to live with my mistakes. And that was a mistake.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
So Thanksgiving is canceled.
what did they do?
Are we sure we want to move forward with this episode?
Because
I don't think are we thankful? Are we still?
I have a question.
Should we bring that cheer?
I have a question.
Okay, what?
Okay.
A question.
A big part of the Thanksgiving tradition in the United States of America, which, spoiler, is where we record from, is the traditional pardoning of the Thanksgiving turkey,
yes.
Which is the president's job.
Yes.
And I'm really curious whether our president...
Are you going to get topical right now?
We're going to make a prediction.
I'm being topical.
We're going to make a prediction.
I'm really curious. I'm very, very fascinated to see...
Pardon or not?
Whether President Donald Trump does in fact get around to pardoning a Thanksgiving turkey. I kind of feel like he's in a bad mood, and I really wonder whether he's just going to... If he's just going to say no, let
if
it die.
If he's just kind of a grumpy pants, and he might.
he's going to insist on it paying for its crimes.
You know, all I can see is the line of people that Donald Trump is going to be pardoning anyway, right? Like, there's just this line, like, in my head, it's this single file line waiting at the White House door, and a turkey, like, putting on a hat and waiting in that line, like, hoping that he, too, gets pardoned this Thanksgiving.
You know, I bet the New Yorker is going to have a very topical comic on this.
Oh, yeah. A nice cover.
If only we could, like, read a book by a New Yorker cartoonist on this podcast.
Someday.
Oh, well.
Well, I'm glad someday. You guys have brought books you're thankful for. I know our alternate theme was genocide. So
hashtag genocide.
Hashtag genocide. But I think this is Which a little bit more like, palatable.
It doesn't work. I mean, no.
Those are two very different feeds.
That seems like a really, that seems like a pretty dark, but I would be interested in what Joe would bring for if genocide was the theme.
Oh, no.
Why would you say it like that?
Yeah, no, I'm just curious.
Has Joe committed genocide in the past that we're concerned about what book he would bring? Yeah.
I hope Joe incriminates himself.
Okay.
Yeah, genocide is the theme.
We'll probably just move on from this subject, I think.
You don't want to talk more about genocide.
Okay. Well,
weirdo.
Whatever, man. It's probably trending. It's probably trending on social media, Nick.
Well, we're talking about it, so obviously we have that kind of clout.
I'd like to kill this topic and move on to a new one.
That's good. That's a good segue.
Okay.
Nick, can you go ahead and take a segue point, please?
So speaking of segues,
I got a new scooter recently.
Speaking of genocide, I'd like to go over our show rules and then we can proceed. We have a couple rules on You Don't Know Lit, just to set the tone here. Rule number one, only unavoidable spoilers. Rule number two, omit needless words, Joe. And number three, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. And every week we take two books and we make them fight a brutal, brutal death.
It's really hard. Like, the magic to animate these things is really, really difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ian and I spend all week practicing our incantations. We draw glyphs on the floor, or at least I draw glyphs on my floor. I can't speak to Ian.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been experimenting with runes, but yeah, basically the same.
Mm-hmm. And so we're going to do that now. Guys, Joe, do you want to give me your 30-second plot?
Yeah. So
okay, your time already started.
Oh, good. Oh, no, I got nervous now. Slapstick is Kurt Vonnegut's worst book. At least that's what he called it. I must have terrible taste, though, because it's one of my favorite books of all time. It follows the life of Dr. Wilbur Daffodil 11 Swain, a grotesque and ugly man who, along with his equally repulsive twin sister Eliza, was cut off from modern society from his parents. The siblings came to realize that even when close physical contact. Yeah, it's I
you,
really,
where,
I
started
failed.
So
oh,
strong.
Yeah,
you started so strong, and then it just you started to tell the whole story of the book.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I did because I only got like halfway through what I have written here.
Okay.
That's okay. Nick, you should read Slapstick.
Certainly a taste of what's to come. Ian,
yes,
you like to go now.
I'd love to go.
Ian.
Yeah.
Can you take 30 seconds to just give me a quick teaser about what your book is about? And based on that, I will decide who gets to go first.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a really good plan, Nick.
Okay,
thanks for coming up with that.
Yeah, no problem. Fantastic. Go for it.
We all love Easter eggs in fiction. Like when Superman puts on the glasses, it's a reference to this storyline or whatever.
Uh-huh.
My book this week takes our delight in the Easter egg to its logical conclusion. What if there were a book that was completely made up of Easter eggs? Turns out this book exists. It's pretty interesting. And it's called Silverlock by John Myers Myers.
John Myers Myers sounds like a serial killer name. Like what's the guy's, what's the guy's name?
John Wilkes Booth?
No. Bateman. No, never mind. I'm thinking Patrick.
Jason Bateman.
Yeah. No.
You think they're related, those two guys? That would make a lot of sense.
The actor Jason Bateman and the fictional character
from American Psycho.
From American Psycho. Yes.
Yeah. That's what I'm referring to.
Probably.
the sigh of disappointment and just weariness was so eloquent.
Sure.
Probably.
Well, we really cut Joe off, so I'd like for him to go first. I got a lot more questions.
That's so kind of you. All right.
Also, Vonnegut tends to be a downer, so I'm hoping Ian sounds real fun, so we'll end on a high note there.
Okay. Yeah, it's a bit of a downer.
Yep.
So, Nick, slapstick
Does this start in Dresden, too, or?
No.
So let me tell you about firebombs.
So it does start...
Do you guys use firebombs when you battle each other?
My book is actually equipped with firebombs this week. That's its
Oh, that's yeah. It's like Pokemon type. Like weapon you brought of a choice, fire yeah. type.
Books right. Joe's book just slaps. It's
Oh, that's so funny,
Nick,
Joe.
Nick, are you familiar with the teenage slang? If you call say something slaps right now, do you know what that means?
Oh, is this like a new thing? New slang?
I mean, relatively new. I'd say within the last year.
Something like about booty clapping, it sounds like. Is that what it is?
So if something slaps, Ian, you must know it, Ian.
Yeah, it's like it rules. It rocks.
It's totally just the best. So, Nick, I really do like the play on words. My book does indeed slap this week.
Now, is this a comedy? Slapstick? Like, is it have a lot of jokes in it? Like, it's a good time?
Is it a bunch of pratfalls?
So,
answer the questions.
Not going to lie, guys. It's a little bit dark.
Oh, crap.
Yeah.
Okay. I hate it when he does
this. It's a dark comedy.
let me give you a brief overview of the plot.
That would be nice.
Give us a thumbnail.
Thumbnail.
Give us your thumbnails.
Okay, I will send them to you. Okay, so there's these two kids in Slapstick, a guy named Wilbur Swain and his sister Eliza, and they are born incredibly wealthy geniuses. But
love this book already. Very identifiable.
But
good for them.
They're only geniuses when they're within physical proximity to one another. Like they function almost like two halves of a brain. Wilbur can read and write. Eliza does the thinking. And together, they estimate that they're about 10,000 times smarter than either one of them is individually.
That's a huge variance.
It's a huge
variance.
It's
like the equivalent of like they can pick up a rock to they're flying through outer space.
Yes, exactly. Like without one another, they are of incredibly average to like low intelligence. Together though, they are like hyper intelligent.
Yeah. Like they're getting D minuses for sure.
Yeah. Together though, they like see the fabric of the universe. Like that's like the level of intelligence that they are together.
So Joe, let me just stop you right away. Yep. Fiction?
Yeah. So okay. Fiction. Also like I think
Nick, were you making sure that wasn't gonna happen?
So not only fiction, but I think one of Kurt Vonnegut, who is a science fiction writer, I think it is probably one of his most science fiction-y books that he writes. Okay. Finishing up the plot. They want to protect themselves from like what will happen if their genius is discovered. So they pretend for all the world to be just imbeciles. Eliza, though, is sent to live in a group home, and Wilbur is raised by the inheritor of the Swain family name, and they go off to live their separate, averagely intelligent lives. Eliza in this group home, and Wilbur as kind of like the next in line for this prestigious family.
I have so many questions.
There's so many.
Can I Wilbur ask becomes, a couple?
Can I have one more sentence and then yes?
Okay.
Because I think the last sentence is really. Wilbur becomes a doctor and then senator and then eventually the last president of the United States. Ooh. And after society's collapse, he becomes the king of Manhattan. Eliza dies in an avalanche on Mars. Nick, I will take any questions that you have.
Wow, that really took a left turn.
Yeah.
How much of that was a spoiler, Joe? Because it sounded like a lot.
can you chart how unavoidable these spoilers are?
Yeah, it sounds like you just described how the book ended.
No.
Did you?
In fact, like so many of Vonnegut's books, I think they are almost spoiler proof because what happens, like the books so often are not about like what happens in the book.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. Yeah. So couple questions. Why didn't they stick together? That seems like a big miss.
Good question.
That's where I'd like to start with that one.
Yeah, so they're forcibly separated. and I won't go into it too much, but essentially their parents kind of find out about their ruse, that they're pretending to be imbeciles, and they're repulsed by it. Especially when
they go... Is this like an incest, underlining incest tone to it?
Oh, yeah. There's all sorts of incest undertones in this book. It's like, at one point in this book, Wilbur and Eliza are reunited.
They do have incest.
So at one point in this Eliza are reunited, and they basically get together in what Vonnegut describes as a 5-day long orgy of reading and writing and thought and like sniffing, and it's very like physical.
Wow, this just got dark. Ian, do you want to chime in here?
No, I'm still kind of absorbing
it. Completely disgusted.
Is it like the idea of sort of like intellectual intimacy as opposed to physical intimacy?
Well, it's intellectual intimacy in addition to physical intimacy. Like when they are in these, like,
are there any gentlemen D's?
We should not have told him that phrase. It's a mistake. I have a question, Joe.
Yes.
This is maybe more of a macro question. Mm-hmm. So, drawing upon your presentation of Slaughterhouse Five, which you kind of framed as like very much driven by his desire to say something, you know, Vonnegut is using fiction to do a thing in the world. Mm-hmm. He wants to say firebombs are bad and Dresden is cool, and so he writes Slaughterhouse Five.
Yeah.
I think I'm understanding correctly what happened in that book.
Yep.
Does Snackstick,
mm-hmm.
Jackling's Snackstick,
yep,
does Snackstick, does Snackstick have like a didactic element? Is like trying to like tell us stupid people are good or what?
So
like you, is it saying like if your children are intelligent, you should separate them from each other?
What's the overt message?
For all the craziness of this plot, I think one of the most interesting things is Vonnegut has said on multiple occasions that this is the closest he will ever come to writing an autobiography.
Oh dear. Curtis.
Hey guys, can we just can we stop and just let's just get incest out of our mind? Let's just move on talking about this wonderful book and just get incest just out of the narrative and go.
I'm going to do a control find in my document for the word orgy to see how many times it shows up.
Well, I feel like you didn't, you're not getting it out of your mind, Joe.
9 times. The word orgy shows up 9 times in this.
All right.
All right.
Get an explicit tag on this episode.
Earning it this week.
Earning it.
So Vonnegut writes about this book. Vonnegut writes about this book, or writes this book, and he says it's the closest he'll ever come to an autobiography. And he says, in reference to the title, he says, this book, I think, is interesting to know. It's dedicated to Laurel and Hardy. And Vonnegut says in the foreword, this is the closest I'll ever come to writing an autobiography. I've called it slapstick because it's grotesque situational poetry, like the slapstick film comedies, especially those of Laurel and Hardy of long ago. It is about what life feels like to me. And this book arose out of kind of tragic circumstances. Vonnegut had a sister. I don't want to look too far into this, right? But Vonnegut had a sister named Alice. This book was written in 1976. Alice, who he was super tight with, dies in 1958, and she has 3 sons. Vonnegut adopted all 3 of those sons and would raise them. Yeah, he would raise them as his own until, like, through their lives.
Wow. How old were they? Like, I would imagine.
They were like
little
boys.
It's a dumb question, I guess, but.
Yeah, they were young. They were later in his life, shortly before this book was written, they had an uncle that died. And the uncle death was kind of unrelated to these 3 boys. I mean, it had been, 8 years or so since then. But he said that when his uncle died, he was on an airplane to go to the funeral. And this whole book came to him in a dream that he had on that airplane.
No.
Right. And it really is this book about the kind of like the happenstance of life, about like the in some ways, meaninglessness of life. I don't want to like lean too far into that, but I think it is like, hey, life is kind of random and kind of crazy, and this is what life feels like.
Hmm.
Tell me about the world that they live in, because it sounds, when you said, it sounded like a fine world, and then you said last president, and then I started thinking, uh-oh, is something happening? So tell me
Does he come unstuck in time?
No.
He does not come unstuck in time, but the best part about this book, I'm so happy you asked, because the best part about this book is the science fiction-y stuff about this book.
Okay.
Vonnegut, as I said earlier, he talks about this as the worst book he's ever written. And a lot of that had to do with the critical reception of it. This came out after he had written Slaughterhouse-Five, which kind of catapulted him into fame. And people were expecting like a big follow-up, right? And instead, he wrote this. And the New York Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek, the New York Review of Books, The Village Voice, Rolling Stone, all of them really kind of panned it in their reviews. And Vonnegut took it kind of hard.
Not a bunch of dicks.
Yeah, a bunch of jerks. My favorite stuff about this, though, is the world. This is what I want to do. I just want to give you guys like some kind of facts or things that happen in this world. And I just want to like leave them there for us to talk about, like follow up if you want, or if you don't want to follow up, I'll just move on to the next one.
Sounds amazing.
Okay.
Do you have a fun name for these?
Yeah.
These facts.
Yeah. A fun name. Like enjoyable facts.
No, I mean like we've done like
facts,
Quorum Facts, McFacty.
Vonnegut.
Vonnegut. Kurt Vonnegut.
We can't just make it a portmanteau.
Yeah.
I like it. How about Vonnegut it?
Vonnegut it.
I Vonnegut it.
Vonnegut after
it.
I Vonnegut it.
Okay. So one thing that's happening in the world.
Vonnegut after it, Joe.
I Vonnegut after it. One thing that's happening in the world of this book is the Chinese are shrinking themselves to become more efficient.
Just stop.
Why didn't you leave with that?
Physically?
Physically shrinking themselves to become less of an impact on the world that they live in.
Brilliant.
So it's like an ecological thing.
It's like an ecological thing, yes.
Good. I appreciate that.
They're going green by going smaller.
it's like they say, we need to reduce our carbon footprint. Why don't we just make our feet smaller?
Yeah, that's the best way to do it, is to literally
carbon footprint.
Literally decrease your footprint size.
At one point, the main character here, Wilbur, has an emissary from the Chinese government come to meet him, and he's about the size of a thumbnail, and he is sent as an emissary.
So they're successful.
Oh, no. They get very small.
Okay. It's bizarre.
He's chosen as an emissary because of his tremendous size, because he's as big as a thumb, so you can see him with your naked eye. Speaking of going green, the Chinese shrink themselves so small that they actually become like an inhalable plague. Like people in America start dying because they're inhaling Chinese people.
This seems kind of racist.
This seems... All right.
Or like it has the possibility of being pretty racist.
Is just... Can you explain to us what you think the meaning is of this? Because I can't understand it without reading the book, but like what is the subtext?
I don't think it comes across as racist. I think it does come across as the unfamiliarness of China, like the mystery of China. Like at a certain point, all of the Chinese delegates just leave the United States and go back to China. And when somebody asks why, they say, well, we don't really think we have anything to learn from the United States anymore. So like, we're just going to go do our own thing. And the Chinese really like do their own thing throughout this. They're always kind of like this background, not a threat, but like this background, almost like people to be admired in the book.
Okay. Let's keep going with these Vonneguts.
Yep. Absolutely.
Let's Vonnegut a couple more.
Let's Vonnegut some more. The apocalypse in this book, because he is the last president of the United States, is really unique. It starts because of gravity experiments that are either happening naturally or happening like from an enemy. And all of a sudden on the planet, one day, gravity gets like so heavy that buildings collapse, elevator shafts, like elevator cables snap, like the guts fall out of horses, like the gravity just multiplies.
Aw, poor guys.
So it's a really, and then that followed by they run out of oil, there's a Martian plague, the microscopic Chinese we've talked about.
Can I, Vanna, get you guys a 1-star review?
Yeah.
Okay. It's a 1-star review on Slapstick from Mike. It says, Slap sucked.
That's pretty good.
That's tight. It's a nice, tight response.
Yeah. It's only a couple more letters long than the name of the book, so I feel like it's pretty good. It's efficient.
It's perfect. It's good.
It's one letter longer. Wow. Man, we just, like, we've lost that. As our culture, we've lost that ability to be so, so specific and precise. Just like, oh, that's poetic. That's poetic in its concision.
It is good. It is good. It's like a really good, like, nickname that a bully would call like a helpless kid.
Yeah, and like it would mess you up. Here's my thought.
You'd think about it for years.
Maybe.
I'm going to think about this review for years. Certainly whenever you read this book, Joe, you're going to think about how it slaps sucked.
Yeah, that will stick with you. It's a sticky review.
Fucking Mike.
Hey, fuck you, Mike.
Fuck you, Mike, you fucking bully.
What if we adopted this as an alternative format for this podcast?
Okay.
What if the challenge was for Joe and I to deliver a assessment of our book that was as many letters or fewer letters than the title?
Okay.
Ooh. Would it have to be a pun? Would it be a pun upon the title?
I don't think it has to be, because that would be
even
more
difficult. More rules except the one that Ian just outlined. So what?
Okay. Just like shorter.
Already, this is incredibly impossible.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are you presenting, Ian? Silverlock?
It's a very short title.
Oh, shoot. You really put a lot of pressure on yourself and also us, so we don't like you for that.
Yep.
Joseph, please continue.
Yes. Okay. Once the cool post-apocalyptic stuff happens, or once the cool apocalypse happens, the post-apocalypse is really cool.
That's when the postmen.
Yes, when the postmen bring the fury, the fire.
Start increasing their size.
The United States breaks up into these feudal lands, and there's like kind of civil war, but it's not two sides against each other. It's kind of a free for all. And you get like these cool titles of leaders, like the King of Michigan or the Duke of Arizona.
Oh, like the warring, like a tribal warfare, like in that Mad Maximilian.
Absolutely. It's totally tribal.
And Pete Davidson is there. He runs Staten Island.
Good. That's also topical.
There's a telephone where people can speak to the Ted.
Ted?
I'm sorry, Ted Danson? There's a telephone where people can just call the dead.
Oh, the dead. Mm. I thought you said Ted.
Yeah.
I kind of wish there were a telephone where you could just call Ted Danson. I would have a thing or two to say to him.
I'm sure he's got a phone.
Just a red phone on your desk, the Danson line.
Like the Batman phone, but it just calls Ted Danson.
And he always answers. He never doesn't answer.
It rings like twice, and then he always picks up. Very reliable. Wait, so you talk to the dad? How is this? Like, okay, you keep saying science fiction, blah, 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 but it sounds a lot more like fantasy, honestly. Like, I mean, this is a question that that gets thrown around, and maybe it's not useful for this novel, but like, does it seem like it's kind of leaning like this could scientifically happen? Is it offering scientific explanations, or is it it's happening,
no,
it's weird.
It's not offering scientific explanations, it's not real.
Oh no, I disagree. Like so often in science fiction, they do offer a scientific explanation for this phone that speaks to the dead. There's essentially like a mini super collider in the fields outside of Iowa where this phone exists, and they have
super
this like
collider.
Finely tuned antenna that has to
of
do with
course.
Like a milk bucket purposely propped up. So there is
awesome.
And the last thing I want to talk about.
Nah, it's got a double super collider. That's fucking talking to the dead and make the courses explode.
1.21.
They don't explode, their guts fall out.
Yeah. Oh, so different. Clearly.
they fall out.
I mean, I guess I didn't grow up on a farm, so I wouldn't know.
Where do they fall out of?
Like they break through their stomachs. Okay.
Wait, so why do the guts fall out but not the bones?
There must be a hole in which they fall out of.
I think maybe
otherwise it's an explosion.
Okay, fine. The horses explode. This isn't the hill I'm going to die on. The horses explode.
Sweet.
Nick, we won.
I digress. Continue, Joe.
So the last thing I want to talk about here is I was terrified to reread this book. This is hashtag thankful this episode, right?
Yes. Why are you hashtag thankful for this book?
I chose this book because like Kurt Vonnegut was recommended to me by a high school intern that we had, librarian-ish.
A returning character.
Do Nothing Dave, yeah. Do you mean?
Do Nothing Dave. Good job, Nick. Yes. And I think that this book in so many ways set me on my path. When I first read this book, I remember like viscerally having this reaction where I thought, I didn't know a book could be like this. Mm. And when I read this book, like especially after so much I've heard about it in the past, like since I've read it, I found out that like it was panned by critics, that Vonnegut himself didn't like it. And I'm sitting here going, oh my God, I love this. This book was so important to me. Like I love this. So yeah. I was so scared to reread it this week for this episode. But when I read it this week, I had just a blast, like just an absolute blast rereading it. And I think it's because of the stuff that you're talking about, like these like crazy science fiction scenarios, like these scenarios that I haven't seen in other science fiction. But this book like sent me down a whole new path and it really turned me into a book lover, I think, right? I was a sophomore in high school. I had read up until that point, but this book turned me into a book lover. And I think by extension, eventually, and English teacher talking to you chuckle fucks every week, right?
There's a direct line between,
like, I can draw a line from Do Nothing Dave handing me like this book or pointing me towards the Vonnegut shelf and sitting in front of my microphone looking at my waveform tonight. So I do, when I think about hashtag thankful, like I do think about like this book being this turning point in my life.
So this book sounds pretty wild. It sounds like
it's pretty wild, like a
drug induced crazy
a romp.
Yeah, romp.
It is a romp. It's a good old fashioned romp.
A real drug induced romp. Where horses
explode.
Exploding horses prevail.
It's got all the characteristics of a classic drug induced romp. Exploding horses, maybe incest.
Ted Danson. This sounds like a good book, Joe. I would read it. I'd read anything he writes. I feel like if, you know, there's certain writers where it's like, hey, man, I'll read anything you do.
Yep. Right. I'm in.
You know, yeah, I'm in.
Yep.
And you got to take the great with the
weird.
Weird, interesting, less than great. I don't know. But like, whatever. Fuck those. You know, there's one thing to leave a one-star review that just says slap sucked. But when you write like a whole article about how somebody's entire like work is like a piece of shit and like give it a one-star like the New York Times, that's a whole nother level of like, I don't think the world needs that. Just
kind of negativity.
Yeah.
Critics, literary critics, just tell us how good books are. That's
literary
all we want to hear.
Critics. Well, here's the thing. Don't talk about the bad ones.
Oh, yeah.
Ignore them.
Ignore the bad ones and they'll go away.
If you ignore something, it definitely goes away.
Yeah.
Like I have this spot on my skin and it's, I'm just going to leave it be. It'll probably be fine.
Hey, have you guys ever noticed all of the really bad, movies on Netflix ever?
I just watched one last night, as a matter of fact.
Yes. They're really, really bad. Just like the C level celebrity movies.
It's like the opposite. Quantity over quality.
Yeah.
Right. Just churn them out. Like we need viewable hours. We need viewable hours.
I have read that like this is really, really good for the film industry though. because like many people are getting work.
It's because there's never been more content.
Right. This massive, I mean, we're contributing in our humble way, an hour plus of content every week. And, you know, we are personally employing, I think, at least 850 people in the whole production of the episode. Right, Nick? That's what you said?
Let me just, 851, actually.
850. Oh, we hired that guy. Cool.
Yeah. We hired Do Nothing Dave.
He's here.
Yeah. Well, he's not here yet.
He's clearing the paperwork.
We hired him like 2 weeks ago. He hasn't showed up yet. So.
He hasn't filled out his paperwork.
Wait, why did you hire someone named Do Nothing Dave? Is that his legal name?
He had a good reference. He knew somebody on the show.
We go.
Maybe I should track down Dave and he could be our first guest.
I love it.
That would be the most cruel thing.
I don't know.
So how did you introduce me?
Funny story.
So do you guys know of any terrible Netflix shows that were actually good books?
So I've got a good book that I hope will become a not terrible Netflix movie. I want to bring Hillbilly Elegy by a guy named J.D. Vance.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so this is actually supposed to be, it's like a Oscar favorite.
Yeah, yeah, it's like, it's legit.
I think our boy Ron Howard is directing this one. Is that
Amy
correct?
Amy Adams, Glenn Close, Frida Pinto, not the same Frida from the Unibrow painting.
That's Frida Kahlo. Yes.
Or the potato chip Fritos.
That's actually not
Fritos.
She had a magic like one wish, and she wished to be transformed into a brand of chips. And so here we are.
So good for her.
Eyebrows on your chips. I would like to bring... I don't know how the movie is because I haven't seen it, but I'm going to watch it in preparation. There is a novel that it was written in 1938 by Dame Daphne du Maurier, and the novel is called Rebecca. And it's a really good book. I've been reading the book and I flipping love it. It's a really good book. And this author, well, I won't spoil that. But she writes really scary stuff, really freaky stuff. And this was released in October, the film version, film remake, I guess, on Netflix. And apparently it has received mixed reviews. So.
Ian.
Hey.
What book do you have? What book are you thankful for?
I am thankful for Silver Lock by John Myers Myers.
Cool.
This is a really good book. And I think it's great. And I want to talk to you folks about the book.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody.
In case you've forgotten the way this works, I like the book and I want to tell you why it's good.
Oh, okay.
I'm gonna talk about this book. And I think I first want to just get out of the way the central conceit, because I would say
get it out.
I would say what happens in this book is less important than what its nature is. And I'll explain.
Okay.
So
you better explain, because I feel like you could say that about every book, but keep going.
Well, yeah, maybe. I don't know. The book is a journey. At the most central, at the most basic, this book is a journey. There is a main character named Shandon who has an MBA from the University of Wisconsin, and his name, he's
Booyah.
His name was Booyah.
I kind of think the thing is, the author wanted to make him seem kind of boring and bland.
Boo.
I think the most boring degree he could have is an MBA, which is fair. And the most boring university you could think of is University of Wisconsin.
Yeah, as a Wisconsinite, I do take offense to this, but also understand completely.
I think Nick's wife has an MBA from the University of Wisconsin. Doesn't Annie have an MBA from the University of Wisconsin, Nick?
Yeah, that is correct.
Ooh, sucks, yeah.
She's offended more than I am.
This is what it's like to be a Wisconsinite.
Yes.
You take offense at it, but you're also like, yeah, it's kind of true.
Oh, yeah.
So this guy, this character, so he's sort of bland when we first meet him, and his adventures change him, as adventures often do. So he's shipwrecked, and he travels through this fantastical land called the Commonwealth of Letters. I'll explain what that is in a second. He tries to survive. Basically, he's just trying to stay alive because there's a lot of danger and a lot of violence, and he helps people along the way.
And a little gremlin tries to eat him.
Yep.
Is that accurate? Are there gremlins in this? Are there gremlins in Silverlock?
There are so few gremlins, and this is one of the biggest.
And a big spider.
Criticisms leveled against this book is that it should have had more gremlins. Oh,
right.
It was
that can be said about a lot of books.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's maybe we should begin every episode with a gremlin count, like how many gremlins are in this book, and
on a scale of important narrative one to gremlin, how many gremlins does a gremlin?
Absolutely. Well said. I couldn't have said it better myself. So let me just finish up what he does here, okay? He tries to make it. He tries to survive. He helps people that he meets, and he does meet a pretty eclectic cast of characters. There are a few quests that he goes on throughout the book, trying to find people, trying to save people. One quest takes him to actual hell, where he meets actual Satan. But the main point of the book is... Yeah, we're going to get to that in a second. The main point of this book is his journey and the experiences he has, the people he meets, and the way this changes him from kind of a bland fellow who isn't excited by the world to somebody who truly values and loves adventure and getting out there and experiencing things.
Now, why is this the conceit? It seems like it's just the whole thing.
Well, okay.
What's wrong with what you said?
This is the structure, right? This is the skeleton
okay.
of it.
Okay.
The real draw of this book is the fact that everything in this book is a reference. Literally everything, every character, every narrative event, the places, names, all of it. Yeah. There's a whole chapter where you're just scratching your butt and belching, and it's kind of gross, honestly. Really don't like it.
Classic, Nick.
So it's like Ready Player One.
Is it like Ready Player One? Is Ready like Player Ready One Player? In it?
No, it's written in 1949, so a little bit before all of these, before these touchstones of cultural development, such as Nick Argyris and Ready Player One. It is. That's a really good connection. It's like Ready Player One, except for if instead of video game culture and sort of like 1980s popular culture, it's literary culture. So all of the characters he meets, everyone he meets is from classic literature.
So when he goes through the School of Letters or the Forest of Letters or the Journey of Letters, whatever.
The Commonwealth of Letters.
It's like the Commonwealth of Letters and Science or the Commonwealth of Letters and Arts. Is that the idea?
Right. Letters meaning literature.
Right.
So Beowulf, friend of the show, is in here.
All up in
the
this.
The Mad Hatter, the March Hare, and the Dormouse from Alice, friends of the show, are in here. Mm-hmm. Robin Hood is in here. Odysseus is in here. Paul Bunyan is in here. There are Fairy Queen characters that show up. Huckleberry Finn shows up. Every element of this story, except for its main character, is drawn from previous stories.
I love
which
it.
Which is just...
Yep, book sounds great.
No need to go on. I'm in.
When you start getting into it, you're like, I don't know how it's going to go. I don't know how this is going to go. And what he does is he weaves a pretty good story, and we get to see this central character go from bland, a name like Shandon, which sounds like bland, to... having this pretty awesome, like his change in name.
It sounds like a real slapstick. Ironically.
What does his name change to? Did I miss that?
His name changes to Silverlock, which is way cooler and way more adventurous.
Shandon?
How much of this would your average person pick up on?
That's
a really good question. So as you guys may not know, I have a PhD in literature, literary British literature.
I don't think that's ever come up before.
No, wait, I kind of keep it on the deal. Okay. Piled higher and deeper is what it stands for. Yeah. So I like to think, or sometimes I don't like to think, I shudder to think that I know perhaps more literary allusions than most folks would probably.
Yeah, sharper than the average bear. Right.
I didn't even get everything. Like this dude didn't graduate college. Right?
Not even Ian
can pick up on all of these
with his gentleman's PhD.
Listen, you guys, I can recite the presidents all the way back to the 1850s, and even I couldn't get that. No, I'm just like reading this. I got some of them, and I was pleased by that. But the amount of knowledge that John Myers seems to have of like the huge span of not just like literature in English, but literature in French and literature in German and all kinds of other languages, and not just from like Europe, but from all parts of the world. It's incredible. It's just mind blowing. And he just, he didn't graduate from college. He didn't, he got fired from college because he was writing poetry, which was mocking the professors. And they fired him from college. They kicked him out of college. And yet, here he is, just writing this novel, which is so, so rich in...
Can I add a point to your column? Your author's column?
Yep.
Now, when was this book written?
1949.
Oh, you can't even Google anything. You're just like pulling this out of your brain. Like, no problem, huh?
Like, maybe you have a couple anthologies on the shelf. Like, maybe you have collections of literature on the shelf, you know, it bound it together. But wow.
Because you know, at one point he was like, oh, what was the name of that one little thing? And he couldn't look it up.
Yep. If you didn't remember it, you're just fucked.
He could look it up by going to a like a library. But
how?
Yeah. Well, there were these things called card catalogs.
Yeah, but then what? Where was it in the book, Ian? He couldn't search the PDF by Apple
We have these things called
look
indexes.
Look up gremlins.
Indexes. But I think your point stands, Nick and Joe. I think this is a really good point, and it's also crazy that he didn't write this as an old man, right? He didn't have 80 years to read a billion books and then just kind of take notes and stuff the way Cormac McCarthy would. Mm-hmm. He wrote this when he was relatively young.
This feels like a young man's book to me. This feels like Ian naming all the presidents. Like, that's kind of what this feels like.
I don't know. I really do. See, it's not show-offy, though. Okay. It's really not, because there are some of these which are so, so tucked away, some of these allusions, some of these references, that you have to, like, detective style hunt for clues to find them.
Ian, can I be extremely critical?
Please, I wish you would.
Okay. Who cares? Like,
it's a valid point.
Who cares? Am I going to read this whole thing just because it has references about better books?
Right. Right. This is one of the big things, the big criticisms that's leveled at it.
Okay.
In all truth. And like, it's fascinating that Joe talked about a novel which was novel. It's so like slapstick is so innovative, creative. It doesn't play on existing tropes.
Mm-hmm.
And this novel does. And the criticism is like it doesn't have a concrete plot, and it's just a bunch of stuff. It's just a bunch of references.
Yeah.
And I think I think there is a degree to which
is this the Family Guy of literature?
It feels like a clip show. Yeah, Family Guy.
I don't think so, because there's a tipping point where there are so many that you're not looking for. You're not seeing an author leaning on other people to produce his story. You're seeing an author who is using previous influences, like a weaver weaving a tapestry. And the effect is so powerful that you're just like, my jaw was on the floor. Like, wow, he is weaving so much stuff. And I didn't get everything. I didn't have to. I knew that this was a reference to something, and this is a reference to something, and he's making a story out of them. So the trip through hell towards the end of the book, one of his quests, like he weaves in, it's a pretty classic trip through, like, oh, look, there's someone over there doing their thing. Here's someone over there. But
there's
Satan. There's actual Satan. Yeah. He weaves in all these other characters from classic literature, all these other situations, and he connects them to the story that's come before. So the whole thing hangs together, and you just, it's a tour de force. It's a tour de France, and it's a tour de force. And I think it's pretty awesome. There's a word for this. There's a literary term for this. Can I talk about the literary term a bit, you guys?
I guess so.
Okay, this is the added value I bring to this podcast, literary terms. So the term is intertextuality.
No, I don't know what that means, Ian.
Intertextuality. So it's between texts is the idea of it.
That makes sense.
There's this guy named Christopher Booker who believed that climate change didn't exist, but you should still listen to him for this point that I'm about to make. He said famously, there are only seven plots. Like there are only seven storylines.
Yes.
The idea everything has been done has overshadowed modern literature. Like, there's nothing new ever under the sun. Every book has been written. Every plot point has been played with. Every trope has been explored. Like, there is no such thing as a new idea. And this is controversial, this idea, but widely held. And I think the more we look at it, the more we can say, oh, yeah, I guess there are. I guess there really only are.
Can you name the seven?
Well, I was wondering if you guys wanted to try your hands at it. Like, what are some of the plots?
Can you give us the first one to just give us a sense of how we're supposed to position these?
Sure. So one example of the first of the seven basic plots is overcoming the monster. A main character goes out to find a monster which is threatening the world and defeats it. So Beowulf does this. Okay. Beowulf fights a monster. And so that's an example of one of the plots, overcoming the monster.
Okay.
Okay.
What's another one?
Nick, do you want to go first?
Okay. So I don't know if this is like a story. I should know these seven. So this is a good exercise.
It is.
Now, is Deus Ex Machina, is that something, or is that just a story structure?
That's a trick that authors will use. Okay. The Deus Ex Machina. It's part of, I would say it's part of a lot of plots, but
all right, then let me try again.
Please.
Forbidden love, like a love story.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'll allow that. That's one of them.
Okay. Do you want, well, what is it actually?
Well, I was going to say like a boy meets girl or something like that, or
now we're going to guess, but then you tell us the one we're most related to.
It falls into rags to riches, which is like the big plot where like somebody who doesn't have something acquires the thing that they want. And I think the sort of romantic angle is like you are alone and no one likes you, and then you get a mate and then you're with them. So rags to riches kind of like.
Yep, I think I've got one.
Yep,
I think I've got one.
Go ahead.
I think there is a revenge story, right? Like somebody is screwed over and they spend the novel or the movie getting their revenge.
Yeah, we'll go with Quest. The Quest.
Okay.
Is one which, again, that's broader, like the Lord of the Rings.
Again,
is
very generous.
Being very generous, Ian. Thank you.
these are hard. It took Christopher Booker, climate change denier, 34 years to write this book. Some of the other ones, unless you guys have more.
I have one.
Yeah.
Maybe like denial of climate change as like fact denier. Somebody who denies.
I think Christopher Booker would say that climate change itself is a plot.
What about a redemption tale? Like a tale of redemption. Like I screwed up. I screwed up and I have to make things right.
Yeah, this one's called Rebirth. The process of like the person who is in a bad situation kind of changes and has to become a better person.
Okay. Let's keep going with these, because I feel like these are all biblical at their core, aren't they? Well, I mean, there's a lot of, aren't they?
Like,
I'll go with like the Job story. So like somebody like loses everything.
Absolutely. Tragedy. Oh, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, he shows up. Job shows up in Silverlock, by the way. He's a character in this book.
How do things go for him?
Not well. He's a real bummer.
Boy, oh just goodness. Really on point for Job.
So like
right?
in the really Bible, Job brand. Is presented in the Bible, Job is presented as pretty like he's pretty miserable, but Silverlock makes him even more just depressing and sad, which I didn't know was possible. Yes, Nick, this counts as tragedy. This is one of the plots. Tragedy. Bad stuff happens to
all
you.
All right.
Well, so speaking of tragedy, what about, like, I feel like we haven't hit much on, like, the comedy end of things.
Comedy is
like,
one of them, yep.
Is it just straight up comedy? That's
straight
what you call
comedy.
It?
Straight up comedy, yep.
Awesome.
Like slapstick.
Easy. Like slapstick.
Like slapstick. So you guys have gotten, I gave you one. You guys have gotten five out of the seven. The last one is Voyage and Return, where you head out and you do something, you go to a strange land, you deal with the situation, and you return and you get experiences from it. So these are the seven plots. The idea, like, this is it.
Are we missing one?
Yeah, I feel like that was six.
Overcoming the monster.
Yeah. Yep.
Rags to riches.
Yes.
Yep.
The Quest.
Okay.
Voyage and Return. Mm-hmm. Comedy, tragedy, and rebirth.
Fantastic. We did Good it, job. Joe.
We did it.
All
we
on our
you
own.
Have, you have successfully well, completed Joe and I the podcast.
It. Yes, we did it, Ian.
Your princess is in another castle, I'm sorry to say.
Ooh. Wow, wow.
So this is, okay, this idea that everything has been done is for a lot of authors, kind of a downer. It kind of drags, like it's a bummer. But for this book, it's a strength. So when a book makes a reference to another book, or when a movie makes a reference to another movie, this is called intertextuality or intertextual allusion. When you say, yeah, there are seven plots, this has been done before, so I'm going to make a reference to this thing. So when Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons name a character Ozymandias, this is in part a reference to the poem that Joe read at the end of that episode. This is intertextuality. When Tolkien, this is your Hobbit fact for the day.
Yes.
When Tolkien reads an ancient Icelandic poem called the Edda, the poetic Edda, and he takes the name of a dwarf and uses it in his books to name his main wizard, Gandalf, that's intertextuality.
Wow.
When you make a reference to a previous book, and Silverlock is all intertextual, the whole thing, front to back, top to bottom. I think this is fun.
Yeah. So that was my follow-up question, is like, what's the reward? Like when we talk about illusions in text,
fun,
like, is fun enough?
Is fun a good enough reward?
I think boring English teachers.
Well, because I always have a hard time explaining this. Because so when I introduce illusion in my own class, right? I introduce it through rap music all the time, and I talk about how Jay-Z isn't possible without like the beats of Kanye West, and then I talk about how Kanye West references back to like songs that he performed on his first album, how Chance the Rapper references Kanye, and it's like this cool stuff that builds upon each other.
You really ruin rap for them.
Yeah, I make it so boring.
Hey guys, this thing you liked, it's actually boring.
But if you ask me why it happens, the only way I can ever phrase it is I'm like, because if you hear Chance the Rapper sing this really cool lyric, that's just a cool lyric. But if you know that that cool lyric is built on top of like literally 20 years of music that came before it and it has five different references built into it, it's like that much cooler. But other than saying it's that much cooler, I don't know what to say.
Right. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to kind of
making
make this
a pretty compelling argument for Ian's book here, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. I do think there's a power to allusion and to intertextuality, because you do understand that like books and art in general exist in context. We've talked about this before on the podcast. Books and things happen not just by themselves in a vacuum, but everyone is influenced by everyone else. And I think it takes on exponentially more fascination. So the cool thing about this book is that the main character starts off not having very much imagination and not being a real, like, he's not a real reader. He doesn't read a lot. He's kind of like Nick in a lot of ways.
Sure.
So he's a dude who kind of is boring and bland.
Hey,
and the worst. No, he's a guy who doesn't. He hasn't read a lot. And the process of the book is him being exposed to literally the world of literature. And by the end, this exposure to the world of literature makes him a better person.
Lame.
It makes him a more complete person. So the book is not just working on can you find this, what this reference is? Can you figure out what this reference is? No, at a larger scale than this, it's making an argument for the importance of reading, the importance of storytelling beyond reading. Forget books. Who needs books? This could work at just as well as a film, if it was doing the same kind of thing. Storytelling has value. Storytelling makes our world richer.
Or video games, like we've seen it with, or video games and films. Yeah, we've seen it with Ready Player One. Like, as silly of a reference as that is,
I've come to a conclusion. I think the winner today is not Ian, because I think I would prefer the illusion of an original story than the over the top, over the head understanding that no story is an original. I'd rather have the illusion than
you want to be stuck in the illusion rather than focus on allusion.
Stuck in time, yeah.
Can I talk about why I'm thankful for this book first?
Yes.
Before you make the final call.
Yeah, but I'm not. I don't go back on my word.
Well, as long as it doesn't change next final call.
That's not Joe's choice. Hey, Ian, why are you thankful for this book? Besides the fact that it's Thanksgiving and you have to be thankful,
I have to be thankful for one book. First, I think this is a powerful argument in favor of the use of storytelling. And I think that's a cool thing that works at a meta-textual level that we don't see.
I can't just make up words.
It's also the kind of book that grows the more I read. So this is a book which encourages me to go back to classic literature and to more recent literature to read things that I know I should read and I haven't read yet. And as I read more, as my horizons expand, the book will expand. So this is one of those books that's going to be evergreen. The more I read it, the more frequent I read it, like it.
That's pretty compelling, Joe.
It's going to come. The book is packed. And the more I read outside of this book, the more I'll get next time I come back to it. I'll get references that I had not previously gotten. And I think that's pretty, that's kind of a cool book hack to make your book evergreen like that. The last thing, reason I want to, I'm thankful for this book is because it's broadened my horizons. And at this point, I'm thankful particularly for one of our loyal lit heads, Rachel, who is a recommender of this book. Rachel sent us a recommendation on the website. If you go to our website, you can click on submit a book and you can submit a book and tell us you knuckleheads should read this book. And Rachel did this for this book. And without this podcast and without Rachel's recommendation, I would probably not have found out about this book. So I am thankful for this book. I am thankful for our loyal litheads. I'm thankful for Rachel. And I'm thankful to you, Nick and Joe, for kind of facilitating this broadening of horizons with this podcast.
Oh, Joe, you
pandering.
Lost. What
pandering.
A fucking compelling
this is pandering
ass
bullshit.
Argument. I'm sorry, Joe, you lose.
I didn't realize that we were allowed to make closing fucking statements.
Yeah, of course you are.
Prepared.
Listen, we should level set at the end of each episode a closing argument, shouldn't we?
A closing argument.
So it's not just the last person gets it.
Sweet.
I'm just going to use my closing argument in the future to read my quote.
I love it.
Ah, that is your right. Congratulations to our winner this week, Rachel.
Thank you, Rachel.
You've done it again.
First guess.
So we'll just wait for her to read the final quote. Let's all just wait in silence here.
Sit quietly. While we're waiting for her to tune in,
sure.
I'll just say again, Loyal It Heads listeners, please submit books for us to read. Keep those coming in. This was a really wonderful experience reading this book, and I really appreciate this opportunity to interact with your tastes, your literary tastes.
And even if you don't submit a book, submit a 5-star review on Apple iTunes. And that's appleitunes.com. Appleitunes.com. Oh, man. Suck it, Joe. Ian.
This is bullshit.
Why don't you give us a taste of that sweet callback Family Guy action and channel your inner Rachel from Friends and give us a quote.
So this is a quote. Shandon Silverlock, our main character, has a lot of these moments. As I mentioned at the beginning of the book, he's kind of a knucklehead. He has a lot of these moments where his eyes are opened, and a lot of near-death experiences directly lead to these eye-opening moments. So this is one of my favorite sort of one-liners from this book, which expresses very, very clearly a deep truth about humanity. You guys ready? Strap in.
Ready.
Okay.
Every man knows he will die, and nobody believes it. On that paradox stands not only a host of religions, but the entirety of sane being.
Yeah, that was a real depressing book to go out with.
Thankful.
In an unorthodox approach, I'm going to ask for Joe's final quote, too.
Oh, one second. I actually tore up my notes and put them in the garbage. Let me go
like a little bit.
Get them back.
Wow. To read it.
Joe right. burns down his house every time he loses an episode.
All right, So one of the things that happens in this book, one of the policies of President Swain is that he decides that Americans aren't connected enough to one another. So the government assigns every American a middle name, a new middle name, and that new middle name is your extended family. So you get something like Wilbur Daffodil 11 Swain or Vera Chipmunk 13 Zappa, right? And so you get like this noun and this number.
It's like all airplane stuff.
Yeah, and it's And it's really popular. Like, people love it. Like these people who have been feeling disconnected in their lives, even as the world falls down around them, absolutely love that they have these families, not just that they are like included in, but they also love this idea that there's like these people that aren't part of their families that are like excluded from. And this comes from shortly after this policy has taken hold. It was on that particular visit to Manhattan that I saw my first 13 club. There were dozens of such raffish establishments in Chicago, I had heard. Now Manhattan had one of its own. Eliza and I had not anticipated this at all, that all the people with 13 in the middle of names would naturally band together almost immediately to form the largest family at all. And I certainly got a taste of my own medicine when I asked the guard at the door of the Manhattan 13 Club if I could come in and take a look around. It was very dark in there. "All due respect, Mr. President," he said to me, "but are you a 13, sir?" "No," I said. "You know I'm not." "Then I must say to you, sir," he said, "what I have to say to you. With all possible respect, sir," he said, "why don't you go take a flying fuck at a Rolling Donut? Why don't you take a flying fuck at the moon?" I was in ecstasy.
I don't get it. Hey, Ian, I have a one-star review for your book. Are you ready?
Please. Yep.
Bronze Lock.
It's good. I'm over here applauding very quietly. Golf clap. Bronze Lock.
I just want to yell golf clap at the end of every episode.
That's your new
That's what I do.
That's your new sign off.
Golf clap.